One of the most important questions faced by philosophers and theologians throughout the centuries has been the interplay between faith and reason. The second century church father Tertullian put it this way, quote, "What does Jerusalem have to do with Athens?" Unquote. Are faith and reason enemies, or are they allies? Is the Christian faith reasonable, or is it, as some contend, a blind leap in an irrational dark? A major advance in answering this came with the emergence of a group of medieval theologians known as the Scholastics. Chief among them were Anselm of Canterbury in the 11th century and Thomas Aquinas in the 13th. In his fascinating novel, Pillars of the Earth, Ken Follett spins an intriguing tale of the construction of a cathedral in England. And while the cathedral and the town that it's set in are fictional, Follett does a masterful job of capturing the mindset and vision of medieval architecture. I've had the privilege of visiting the cathedral in Cologne, Germany a few times, and I'm fascinated by what's found there. While some modern American evangelicals may decry tradition and be put off by all the elaborate decoration and religious symbolism of Europe's Gothic cathedrals, most people find them fascinating studies in art, architecture, and with a little research, interesting expressions of theological thought. You see, the Gothic cathedral, it wasn't just a building, it was an attempt to embody the period's thoughts about God and man. As Bruce Shelley says in his masterful church history book, Church History in Plain Language, quote, "The medieval masters of the Gothic style tried to portray in stone and glass man's central religious quest. They wanted to depict a tension. On one hand was man, aspiring to reach the heights of heaven, and on the other hand was God, condescending to address the least of men," unquote. So the pillars, arches, steeples all point up like fingers to heaven, but down comes the light through stained glass windows illuminating the earth, and more specifically, those who've gathered inside the cathedral to see God. It's the architect's version of human reason and divine revelation. The schools these cathedrals housed gave rise to the universities of the late Middle Ages. Their task was to understand and explain creation in light of God's revealed word and ways. As the Crusades had been an attempt to extend the authority of God over the Middle East, the universities hoped to extend an understanding of God and his creation over the realm of the mind. And how did the world of ideas bow to the rule of God? How was reason to be made a servant of faith? This era in Christian thought is called scholasticism because distinctive methods of scholarship arose and a unique theology emerged. The aim of the scholastics was twofold. First of all, to reconcile Christian doctrine with human reason, and second, to arrange the teachings of the church in an orderly system. But it's important we mark at the outset that a free search for truth, it was not on the horizon for the scholastics. The doctrines of the church were fixed. The purpose of the scholastics was to show the reasonableness of these doctrines and explain them. The early universities were intimately linked to the church. They were usually housed in buildings associated with a cathedral. A medieval scholar was most often a priest or a monk. This began centuries before when Benedict of Nursia had insisted that monks study as a means of their spiritual development. In the 9th century, the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne, while dreaming of a Christian empire, widened the opportunities for study through a decree that every monastery also have a school to teach those able to learn. The emperor himself set an example for a palace school, where his children and his court were taught these things. While cathedral schools were set up primarily to train clergy, it wasn't long before even laymen were invited to attend as well. The curriculum was limited to grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, the seven liberal arts, so-called because in ancient Rome, their study had been reserved for the liberi, the freemen. And the few texts available were writings of a handful of scholars of the early Middle Ages. So students learned from Cassiodorus, Boethius, Augustine, Pope Gregory the Great, and a handful of church fathers that the medieval student dared not question. We can track the birth of the great medieval universities to the influence of several outstanding teachers. It was their skill in teaching and enthusiasm for learning that attracted students. Among the first of this new breed of scholar was Gerbert, master of the cathedral school at Reims in the later half of the 10th century. Though he came from peasant stock, Gerbert became Pope Sylvester II. His genius was recognized early on, and so he was sent to study mathematics in Spain. And while he was there, he was exposed to what at that time was the tolerant culture of the ruling Muslims. This was the first of several significant contributions Muslims made to the Christian intellectual awakening of the Middle Ages. Gerbert returned to Reims, greatly impressed by the inquisitive, questing spirit of the Muslim scholars. When he began to teach, he announced that quotations of the so-called authorities were no longer going to be accepted as the final say. From then on, he required his students to study the classics in their original language. He began collecting manuscripts wherever he could and built a substantial library. Now, this was no mean feat when we remember that a manuscript could take a year to copy and costed a fortune. The most notable figure from this early period of scholasticism was Peter Abelard. He was the senior son of a minor noble of northwest France. Peter turned over his inheritance rights to his younger brother so that he could roam France and learn from the great masters. But he did more than listen. He challenged those that he caught in factual or philosophical error. And it wasn't long before he settled in as a lecturer in Paris, where he attracted a host of students. He also began to write. In a tract titled Yes and No, he posed over 100 questions from Christian teaching, then answered them using conflicting quotations from Scripture, from the Church Fathers, and even pagan classics. His point was that there were still many fronts for discussion and inquiry that needed to be resolved. Abelard said, quote, "The first key to wisdom is assiduous and frequent questioning, for by doubting we come to inquiry, and by inquiry we arrive at the truth," unquote. This idea of using doubt to fuel the quest for knowledge was commonplace to the ancient Greeks, but it was dangerous ground to the medieval Europeans. Abelard had a few fans, but many more detractors who were alarmed by his bold questioning of what were considered unimpeachable authorities. Having stirred one too many pots and poked one too many beehives, he decided to lay low for a while in a monastery. A year later, he left the monastery to live in an area southeast of Paris. Supporters there built him a shelter and tilled his land for him, begging him to teach once again. And so, resuming his pursuit of reason, Abelard again fell out with the religious conservatives. And it was now that Abelard ran afoul of a hugely influential character from this time. We've encountered him before, Bernard de Clairvaux, the famous preacher of the Second Crusade and the most influential churchman in all of Christendom. Of Abelard, Bernard remarked, quote, "The faith of the righteous believes it does not dispute," unquote. Bernard managed to have Abelard branded a heretic and then excommunicated. Abelard then retired to the Abbey of Cluny, where its abbot, Peter the Venerable, persuaded Bernard to reconcile with Abelard. The excommunication was lifted, and Abelard spent his last 2 years at the monastery at Cluny, where he was regarded as a great scholar and a wise counselor. I'm going to leave out of this account Abelard's marriage to Heloise, which is one of the most remarkable love stories of all of history. There was an overlooked minor film about Abelard and Heloise in 1988 called Stealing Heaven. It followed their controversial love affair in the 12th century Paris and its tragic aftermath. But listen, no one could stop the growth of the seeds that Abelard had sown. Schools popped up all over Europe. Less than 100 years after his death, universities flourished in Paris, Orléans, Montpellier in France, and then across the English Channel at Oxford and Cambridge, at Bologna and Padua in Italy. All of them were aflame with the ideas that Abelard had ignited. Students and their teachers formed guilds, just as craftsmen had done since the Roman Empire. Scholars now banded together for the protection and promotion of their interests. They called themselves universitas, the medieval name for any corporate group. Now, most students in Italy were grown men who pursued advanced studies in law and medicine. Their guilds exercised tremendous power. Students paid teachers, determined the courses to be given, and they would fine any lecturer who skipped a chapter in expounding a subject. That's certainly turnaround from today's schools. In English and French universities, where students were younger, the scholars' guilds had the upper hand. They forbade swearing and gambling, they fined students for breaking curfews, and they set table manners. Medieval universities were not the ivied walls and grassy lawns that we think of today. At first, lectures were given in shanties and sheds alongside common roads in Oxford and Cambridge. They met inside rooms of the cathedrals in Paris, or open piazzas, that is, plazas, in Italy. Once the prestige and income of a specific teacher rose, he might rent a room for his students where they would sit on straw-covered floors. And because they lacked any fixed property, these students in schools were able to move when they ran afoul of the local authorities. Now, along with lectures, teachers used what were called disputations. In a disputation, two or more masters would debate a text using Abelard's question and answer approach. This was how scholasticism developed. It arose from the painstaking process of arriving at logical conclusions through questioning, examining, and arranging the details into a system of logic. Scholastic disputations often caused heated clashes and bitter feelings. Wars of logic could run for years between different scholars, with supporters of each side cheering their hero with loud whistling and stomping of their feet. The point was, students were learning to think. The unquestioned acceptance of traditional authorities was no longer assured. Now, conclusions had to square with Christian doctrine, which itself was being subjected to the challenges of reason and faithfulness to Scripture. Scholasticism was less a philosophy or theology as it was really a method of learning. The emphasis was on harmonizing faith and reason. The scholastics used the ancient Greek practice of relentless questioning of traditional authorities. Truth would no longer be accepted just because those in authority said so. It was to be rigorously analyzed and brought over into the realm of reason. After all, didn't the Bible say that we are to love God with all of our minds? The scholastics were known for their careful drawing of distinctions. In classrooms and books, topics were vigorously debated, with one of the sides of the debate not even really being believed, but still being proposed as a way to check the value of the side that was being affirmed. Scholastics wanted to harmonize Christian theology with the philosophy of the classical era, especially that of Aristotle and the Neoplatonists. Now, some scholastics of note are Alexander of Hales, Albertus Magnus, Duns Scotus, William of Ockham, and Bonaventura. Two of the greatest of the scholastics were Anselm of Canterbury and Thomas Aquinas. Now, we're going to leave Thomas Aquinas for our next episode because he is a towering intellect, not just for the scholastics, but for church history. Let's finish with a look at Anselm. He was born into one of the many noble houses of Europe in the early 11th century. And because there was little prospect for him to achieve prominence in the political realm, he became a Benedictine monk. His studies quickly marked him as a man of keen intelligence and deep philosophical reflection. He was made Archbishop of Canterbury in England for the last 17 years of his life. Anselm is often called the founder of scholasticism, and he was a major influence in European theology. He's most famous as the originator of the ontological argument for the existence of God and the satisfaction theory for the atonement. That is, that Jesus' death satisfied the righteous requirements of God's justice and judgment. Anselm spent most of his time devising reasonable arguments for theological propositions that he already accepted as true by faith. His goal was not to justify faith by reason. He just wanted to better understand what he believed. And he saw reason as the servant of faith rather than the other way around. Faith came first and guided reason. In fact, he wrote, quote, "I believe in order to understand," unquote. He thought that spiritual things had to be a matter of experience before they could be comprehended by the intellect. He said, quote, "He who does not believe has not felt, and he who has not felt does not understand," unquote. He contended that Christ must come to the intellect through the avenue of faith and not to faith through the intellect. He declared himself against blind belief and called it a sin of neglect when the one who has faith doesn't strive for knowledge. Anselm gave reasonable proofs for God's existence and compelling reasons for God as a self-existent, immaterial, all-powerful, compassionate, just, and merciful deity. In his book, Why the God-Man, Anselm demonstrated the relationship between the incarnation and the atonement. His argument that Christ's atonement satisfied God, it had a powerful impact centuries later on both Calvin and Luther. He wrote on the nature of the Trinity, original sin, free will, the harmony of foreknowledge and foreordination, and why Satan fell. Anselm's two sources of knowledge were the Bible and the teaching of the Church, which he maintained were in total agreement with each other and with all true philosophy. He had the deepest admiration for Augustine, and his agreement with him earned Anselm the titles the Second Augustine and the Tongue of Augustine. Now, besides being a man of genuine piety and devotion to God, church historian Philip Schaff says that Anselm was probably the most original thinker since Augustine. I want to share the interesting story of Anselm's conflicts with two of England's kings. And the best way to do so is to tell the story as Schaff does in Volume 5 of his Church History series. William II, called William Rufus or William the Red for the color of his hair, he was the third son of William the Conqueror, and he ruled from 1087 to 1100. Now, probably the only good that he did during his entire reign was to appoint Anselm as the Archbishop of Canterbury. William inherited all of the vices and none of the virtues of his father. He despised the clergy. It was said that, quote, he feared God but little and man not at all, unquote. He wasn't a skeptic so much as he was profane and blasphemous. He believed in God and hated him. He wasn't married, but indulged in gross immorality. People said that he arose a worse man every morning and lay down a worse man every evening. He plundered the church and oppressed the clergy. He robbed the churches and monasteries of their income by leaving them vacant or selling them to the highest bidder. Within 4 years, he changed 30 cemeteries into royal parks to satisfy his passion for hunting, which in the end cost him his life. When the Archbishop of Canterbury died, William kept the seat vacant for 4 years. Under the influence of severe sickness, he finally yielded to the pressure to appoint Anselm, who just happened to be in England at that point and was well known as a profound theologian of pious character. A greater contrast of men could scarcely be imagined. Anselm did not want to be archbishop. He wanted to return to the life of a quiet monk in his abbey back in northern Italy. But he sensed the call of God, even though if he accepted, he knew that he'd faced a never-ending battle with the English king. He was appointed to his seat to great celebration on the second Sunday of Advent in 1093, and immediately set out to revive the discipline that had fallen away during the previous years. And this was the time of the great papal schism, and King William supported the French Pope Clement III, while Anselm owed allegiance to Urban II. The king insisted on Anselm's receiving the archbishop's pallium, that is his vestment, from Clement, and then demanded that he, as the king, be the one to confer Anselm's authority on him. Now, of course, Anselm refused and took the pallium from Urban's agent, who had brought the vestment to England in a special case. When the archbishop refused to meet the king's ever-increasing financial requirements, the king took him to court. Anselm refused to appear. A civil court had no jurisdiction in church affairs. It was the old question of whether a church official, in his capacity as a clergyman, owed allegiance to the pope or the crown. Anselm managed to secure the king's permission in 1097 to go to Rome, but William sent troops after him and overtook him at Dover. They searched Anselm's baggage and seized the offerings that he was taking to Rome. Anselm's trip ended up as an exile. Anselm was warmly received by the Pope, of course, who threatened William with excommunication and pronounced a curse on any layman who thought, as William had, that he could invest a bishop with spiritual authority. The papal curse went even further to anyone who accepted such a false investiture. Well, in early August of 1100, while hunting in the New Forest, the Red King was killed by an arrow, and no one knows whether it was shot by a hunter or an assassin. There was little mourning for a king that nearly everyone had been hoping would drop dead. They would not have been surprised if a bolt of lightning had slain him. But that wasn't the end of Anselm's monarch problems. When William II died, his younger brother Henry I took the throne. Henry was generally a good king who did much to root out the worst of the corruption at court. He reconciled the clergy by recalling Anselm from exile, but renewed the investiture controversy. He appointed bishops and abbots and demanded that Anselm consecrate them. Anselm refused, time and again, and so he was sent into a second exile. And the queen had an extraordinary devotion to Anselm and tried to mediate between him and her husband. She urged Anselm to return, even if it meant he would have to compromise a bit and grant Henry a measure of power to have a hand in appointing clergy. And she reminded Anselm that the Apostle Paul had circumcised Timothy as a compromise measure. Now, following Urban's lead, Pope Paschal II excommunicated the bishops that had accepted Henry's appointments. But Henry wanted to reconcile with Anselm. So they met in Normandy and agreed to make a joint appeal to the Pope. Paschal then confirmed the king's previous investitures on the condition of his surrendering the right to future appointments. This decision was ratified in August of 1106. The king promised to restore to Anselm Canterbury's income during his absence, to leave off from claiming the income of vacant bishoprics and abbeys, and to refund all fines of the clergy. And while he followed through on his promise not to appoint new clergy, he did send along to vacant seats the names of candidates that he would like to see fill them. So Anselm returned to England in triumph and was received by the queen at the head of the monks and the clergy. At a council held at Westminster in 1107, the king formally relinquished the privilege of investiture. During the last years of his life, Anselm enjoyed the friendship and the respect of the king. And during Henry's absence on the continent in 1108, he was entrusted with the regency and the care of the royal family. Anselm died in 1109. His impact on the bishopric was so great, the seat wasn't filled for 5 years. Now listen, next time we're going to take a look at a real heavyweight among the scholastics in church history, Thomas Aquinas.